When it comes to ensuring your company has top-notch security practices, things can get complicated fast. With Vanta, you can automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, HIPAA, and more. Vanta's market-leading trust management platform can help you unify security program management with a built-in risk register and reporting, and streamline security reviews with AI-powered security questionnaires. Over 7,000 fast-growing companies like Atlassian, Flow Health, and Quora use Vanta to manage risk and prove security in real time. You can watch Vanta's on-demand video at vanta.com/decoder to learn more. That's vanta.com/decoder.
Support for the show comes from Schwab. With Schwab investing themes, you can invest in what's trending in artificial intelligence, big data, robotic revolution, and more. It's an easy way to invest in ideas you believe in. Schwab's research process uncovers emerging trends. Then their technology curates relevant stocks into themes. Choose from over 40 themes, buy all the stocks in a theme as is, or customize to better fit your investing goals, all in a few clicks. Schwab Investing Themes is not intended to be investment advice or a recommendation of any stock or investment strategy. Learn more at schwab.com/thematic investing.
Hello and welcome to Decoder. I'm Neil Patel, editor-in-chief of The Verge, and Decoder is my show about big ideas and other problems. Today, I'm talking to Cloudflare co-founder and CEO Matthew Prince. Cloudflare might be the most important internet company that most people have never heard of. That's almost by design. Cloudflare provides network infrastructure to more than 20% of the entire web. It's effectively what prevents bad actors from around the world bringing down some of the biggest websites on the planet with cyber attacks. But if Cloudflare is doing its job right, you don't even have to know it exists. But once you dive into the reality of what it takes to run Cloudflare, you realize it's an absolutely fascinating company at the intersection of so many of the biggest ideas we talk about here on Decoder. That's in no small part because of Matthew, who has been running the company for nearly 15 years and has had to make some of the most uncomfortable content moderation decisions in the entire tech industry. Because Cloudflare is such critical infrastructure, it's one of the only defenses, in some cases, the only defense, between websites and the people who want to take them down. That includes websites we think are generally good, like news organizations around the world, but it also means unsavory or downright despicable websites, like the neo-Nazi site The Daily Stormer, or forums that breed hate and harassment, like 8chan. Over the last decade, Matthew has had to make the call about when to stop providing services to websites like those. Even though Cloudflare is a protector of free speech and a tool used by journalists, activists, and dissidents in authoritarian regimes, it is a very challenging balancing act, and you'll hear Matthew and I talk about how he makes those kinds of decisions and the company values he says drives them. And those values are under constant pressure. Matthew and I talked about pretty much the entire spectrum of speech on the internet. We talked about the contrast between the United States, which has a First Amendment, and countries overseas, which very much do not. We also talked about how governments around the world might be able to regulate companies like Cloudflare, and what that would even look like here in the United States, or perhaps in a country like India, a democracy whose government still has a very restrictive view of what speech can be on the internet. We also talked about how Cloudflare looks at its role in war zones like Ukraine, and how the threat of a splintering internet, or one that's just more restrictive and more aggressively under attack from bad actors, could undo the last 40 years of what we think of as progress. And something I'd underline is that none of this is theoretical for Matthew. He has been personally sanctioned by the Russian government for providing services to Ukraine. Some notes before we start, because this conversation really went places, and you're going to hear a lot of references to various political philosophers. Aristotle comes up, which Matthew explains, but then we talk about Thomas Hobbes, who believed that nature is cruel and anarchic, and the purpose of government is to enforce a social contract between citizens. We also mentioned John Locke, who expanded the idea of that social contract into what we call liberalism, and whose work directly influenced the Founding Fathers and shaped the Declaration of Independence. And then we mentioned John Rawls, who moved away from the idea of an unchanging natural law into fairness as the foundation of the social contract. I'm aware that this is a lot for a conversation with a guy who keeps websites on the internet, but it is very much why I love doing Decoder. Okay, Cloudflare CEO Matthew Prince. Here we go.
Hey,
Matthew Prince, you're the co-founder and CEO of Cloudflare. Welcome to Decoder.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am very excited to talk to you. It feels like the internet is in a moment of deep and lasting change for a variety of reasons. Cloudflare, I think, is an underappreciated part of the internet for most people. I think if you make internet services, there's nothing about Cloudflare that's underappreciated. If you use internet services, you might not even know Cloudflare exists. It's an important technical piece of the internet. Can you just describe from the beginning what Cloudflare is for folks?
Kind of simplest level, Cloudflare is a service that makes the internet faster and protects it from bad guys. How we do that is we run today one of the world's largest networks. Our customers are anyone who's trying to put content online, anyone who's trying to connect to the internet in a secure way, businesses, not consumers, for the most part. What they do is they put that content behind our network in order to make sure that it can be fast anywhere in the world. It can be reliable no matter what. It can be secure, private, and efficient so that it can reach as much of the internet as possible. Today, we operate that network in over 300 cities worldwide, in over 120 countries, and we're within milliseconds of the vast majority of the users on Earth. And when we're doing our job right, you don't even know that we exist. You just have a better, faster, more reliable internet experience.
Put that next to what most people think about is the internet, right? Cloudflare has a network of its own. It is data centers around the world. Those data centers are close to me physically, such that data might get from the data center to me in milliseconds, as you're saying. But I think most people think about data centers and they think about Google or Microsoft or Amazon. Are you running the same kind of data centers? Are you running different kinds of data centers? Do you work with them? How does that go?
We tend to have lots of machines scattered in many, many places around the world. Whereas what you'd think of as the traditional cloud providers, the AWSs, the Google Clouds, the Microsoft Azures of the world, will have many, many computers, but be more concentrated in individual places. We tend to cooperate really well with those providers. They tend to be much more like the data stores, the sort of the database companies that are out there, whereas we're the networking company that connects those things together. So you would often use one of those traditional cloud providers plus Cloudflare in order to have the best possible experience. And somewhere between 20 and 25% of the web today sits behind us. So chances are everyone who's listening to this has probably used us, certainly in the last 24 hours.
So if I'm starting a website, it's funny I say that I run a website, but let's say I'm starting another website and I say, man, I want to make sure the stuff on my website can get to customers quickly. I want to make sure that I'm protected by DDoS attacks or something. What do I actually come and buy from you?
First of all, you know, we actually believe that our mission is to help build a better internet. And that's not just a better internet for the largest companies in the world. They're all customers as well. But I'm really proud of the fact that, you know, even individual developers, startups, all can adopt Cloudflare. And we actually have a free version of our service, which is really actually pretty astonishing. We don't believe that you should have to have a huge budget to have top grade security, performance, reliability. And so all of those things, you can come up to our website, sign up. You effectively make some technical changes to how your website is announced to the rest of the world that causes that traffic to go through us. Or from the other side, if you're a business and you want to make sure that your employees are connecting to the internet in a secure way, we provide you software that you can install on your laptops or your mobile devices in order to make sure that, again, you're using that network. And so regardless of whether you're publishing content online or whether you're running a business whose employees need to get online, we have a set of services and we try to make them, you know, make sense for you, whether you're small or today, you know, over a third of the Fortune 500 use Cloudflare in order to get those same benefits as well. And we have services for those large companies as well.
You've talked about security a number of times. When I think about Cloudflare, I think about caching mostly. I've got some stuff on my computer or my server or my data center. I do want to put it closer to people so they can access it more quickly around the world. That feels like the big thing that you guys provide to folks. But you've talked about security a number of times. What is the specific security solution that you provide to your customers?
It's interesting that some people think of us for things like caching. So the idea of caching is basically just making a copy of something so that you don't have to move it as far. And the speed of light is only so fast. And so if we can make copies of the logo on a website or the images and move those closer to people, then effectively the online experience gets significantly faster. But that's not where Cloudflare started. In fact, it's actually kind of ancillary to what we did. We're very good at it today. But the original premise of Cloudflare was, how could we make a firewall that was deployed without any hardware, where you could just get it as a service? And the thing was that early on, the objection that everyone had was, you know, that sounds great. You can serve a much broader market. You can make it incredibly easy to use. You can learn from all the traffic that flows through you in order to make everyone more secure. But you're going to add a bump in the wire. You're going to slow things down. And so Michelle, my co-founder, and I, as we were first starting thinking about the business, we became obsessed with how do we make things faster. And caching was one part of it, protocol optimization, just getting, you know, enormous amounts of connectivity around the world were all pieces of the puzzle, but they were really servicing that end goal of how do we make everything more secure. But it turns out that, you know, in most cases, security comes with a compromise of slowing things down. And so when we launched with the goal of just not slowing things down. And then we were a little bit better at it than we intended to be. So not only do we not slow things down, but we actually significantly sped things up. And so today, you know, there are people who may not be particularly worried about cyber attacks who also use Cloudflare. But the great news is, you can be really concerned about, you know, security and you get performance, or you can be really concerned about performance and you get security. And again, I think it comes back to how Cloudflare is living up to our mission of just making sure that everyone online can have the best internet experience, and that our mission is really to help build a better internet.
Who are your biggest competitors?
I think that there are a lot of companies that compete with us in individual areas. You know, you do have companies that focus just on things like caching, the folks like an Akamai or a Fastly, and we compete with them, you know, from time to time if people are just looking at that one thing. You have other companies that are really focused on the VPN replacements of the world. So the likes of a Zscaler, Palo Alto Networks, a Cisco for some of Cisco's products. And we compete with them as well. But I think what's unique about Cloudflare is we offer that complete package, that we can make sure that your content is safe, that you can make sure that your employees are safe. And so if you look across that entire thing, there really aren't that many companies that do everything that Cloudflare does. And what we see from our customers is they really want to have that complete network security package, and they're sick of buying individual point solutions. And so Cloudflare can deliver what we think of as a complete connectivity cloud. And that replaces a lot of the Akamai, Fastly, Zscaler, Palo Alto Networks, a lot of the people who are doing what is traditionally network security. And then, of course, all of the, you know, box vendors, the Check Points and I've forgotten the names of them. That's, I guess, how much yeah, we focus on our competitors. We really are just saying, how can we help make the network experience be the best possible thing it can be? And yeah, we compete with customers in those areas, but there isn't really anyone that does the complete suite of things that Cloudflare delivers.
I just want to point out, if there's one person in the world who would learn the name of enterprise security vendors from the advertising in the airport, it's Matthew Prince. And he, you clearly did not gain that knowledge.
I always wonder who
those ads are for. And I figured you would pay attention to them.
We spend a ton of time focusing on our customers. And we spend a ton of time just focusing on actually how we build a better internet. Even to my board, sometimes chagrin, they're always like, we should talk more about competitors. And I'm like, you know, I think if you just focus on your customers, you focus on building a great product, competitors will follow you as opposed to you having to follow them.
If you hear that sound, it's the price of airport advertising plummeting in the background. I want to talk about competitors along the way here, because I think it's a really important point, because I think there's a lot downstream of whether or not you feel competition. A lot of people characterize Cloudflare as one of the most vital companies in the internet, or acquired company in the internet, and in like a core infrastructure layer of the internet. Do you feel that way about Cloudflare, that you're just part of like the essential utility fabric of the internet now?
When we were just getting started, one of the things that we would always ask ourselves, and this was when it was eight of us above a nail salon in Palo Alto, California, we would ask ourselves, you know, if Cloudflare ran the entire internet, what would the right decision be? And we asked that around technical questions. We asked that around policy questions, around how we did customer support. There was a certain absurdity to it, because again, we were eight people without a single customer above a nail salon. And we would joke that someday if we had an outage or something went wrong, it would be front page of the newspaper, because we would be that important. And we're, you know, we have an incredibly robust reliability record, but we have, when we've had challenges, now it be that level of news. except oftentimes the news publications themselves are Cloudflare customers, so they're offline as well. We take the responsibility that we have extremely seriously, and we try to be a very principled organization and think about what the long term is. People do rely on our networks. There are aircraft that can't take off if Cloudflare doesn't work. There are cash registers around the world that don't work if Cloudflare doesn't work. There are ATMs around the world that don't work if Cloudflare doesn't work. And because of that, you know, I think our entire team is really focused on how do we make sure that we're delivering the absolute highest quality service that we can. And again, when we're doing our job right, we're that thing behind the scenes that's just making everything work better. Most people don't even ever need to know that we exist.
Particularly in enterprise, the notion that you have a single vendor as opposed to multiple redundant vendors, that pendulum swings back and forth, right? Cloudflare is obviously the integrated solution. You provide all of it. You can get all the things you need to run your service across the network. Your competitors, right? It's more mix and match. Yep. You can probably go to them for pricing and competition and discounts, all that stuff. Why do you think your approach has won so definitively?
I think that people want to have one integrated network security vendor. And there are times that can provide really a robust way of protecting your network that you can't get stitching together a number of different solutions. Oftentimes what we see in the security space is that the seams that are created between vendors are often what the attackers exploit. And what we can do is give you sort of a seamless experience where you can see, you know, traffic coming into your network, traffic going out to your network, see that all through one dashboard, give that visibility to all of your employees. That idea of a connectivity cloud that really does connect all aspects of your business together, I think really resonates. The other thing is that we can often deliver it in a much more cost-effective way than individual networks. There is a certain fixed cost to running a network like ours. And the first service that a customer buys from us, you know, costs us a certain amount to provision. But then each additional service that we provision on top of that is actually very, very, very cost effective for us to deliver. And, you know, Michelle, my co-founder, you know, always had kind of almost a mantra that we should always be delivering 10 times the value that we should be capturing ourselves. And I think we've really done that. And what that means is that oftentimes companies can just get a much higher return on their investment. They can save a significant amount of money while at the same time having a better solution, a more integrated solution by switching to us. And so I think over time, you know, it makes sense for you to have one network security vendor. And I think we're well positioned to be that. There are things we don't do. You know, security has other aspects. There's endpoint security, companies like CrowdStrike, SentinelOne. I think that's a very different skill set. And that's somewhere where we'd be much more likely to partner. There's identity, companies like Microsoft and Okta and Ping Identity that provide those services. Again, I think that's somewhere where we think it makes a lot more sense to partner. But in the network security space, we think that one integrated solution is able to not only deliver the best experience, but also be able to deliver it in a way which is the most cost effective.
So that's what Cloudflare is as a business. I think most people don't have that insight. Let me ask you some of the decoder questions now. You mentioned 8 people in a nail salon. How big is Cloudflare now?
About 3,500 people around the world and very, very, very global. So we run what is an incredibly global service, and our team is distributed very globally around the world.
And how is it structured?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
The classic way of answering this is telling me whether you're divisional or functional. Some people actually just go through their whole org chart, which is very entertaining. It's a show about org charts at the end of the day. But how do you think about how the company is organized?
There's one P&L at Cloudflare. We try to be as flat as possible. Generally, the metric that I pay a lot of attention to is what's the average number of direct reports that a manager has. We try and get that number around sort of 8 direct reports, which is on the high side. Most companies are around 5. That tends to make the structure a little bit flatter. Michelle, my co-founder, and I, Michelle's our president and COO, and we split the world up. She handles a lot of the go-to-market and HR and support side of the business. I handle a lot more of the product engineering, finance, and legal side of the business. And those are sort of where we divide things up. We have not split up into GMs. I think the one thing that we've done, which is a little bit unique at Cloudflare, is we really have 3 different sort of product and engineering teams that have somewhat different mandates. have very different mandates, ultimately around the time to market and the time frames that they're thinking around. So a traditional product and engineering organization, which is, you know, I don't know, 80 to 90% of our R&D budget, is what everyone, you know, thinks of. They think in sort of, you know, two-quarter roadmaps, spend a ton of time talking to customers, listening to what they want, trying to deliver that, think about what our products are and how, you know, they can move up and to the right in a Gartner or Forrester, you know, survey, and make what is incredibly important, but very much sustaining innovation around the products that we already have. We have a second, you know, R&D org, which is, you know, again, approximately, call it 10 to 20%, it varies depending on the time, of the R&D org. And that's what we call ETI, or Emerging Technology and Incubation. They don't think in sort of two-quarter timeframes. They think in sort of 2 to 3 year timeframes, and very intentionally spend very little time talking directly to customers. They spend a lot of time thinking about, with the resources that Cloudflare has, with the network that Cloudflare has, if we look out over the horizon, what's the thing that someone's going to want 2 years from now and that we can deliver? And their job is to take lots of shots on goal. And ideally, you know, 80, 90% of them never see the light of day, but some of them do. People can rotate in and off, in and out of the ETI group, but it's almost like a little skunkworks team inside of Cloudflare. And a lot of the really big leaps where we've, you know, provided things like our developer platform, a lot of the work that we're doing around AI today comes out of that group. We have a third group, which is the smallest of it. Often it's made up of a lot of people who are getting their PhD in computer science, or, you know, they're taking time off to do an internship, or some people who would almost be like professors at a lot of universities. And they are thinking more in a 5 year time frame on fundamental internet technologies, as we have things like TLS 1.3, which is the encryption protocol that, you know, protects how, when you put your credit card in, that it's secure, or as we're thinking about things like quantum cryptography. They're the team that's thinking on that longer time frame on what is it the internet's fundamental protocols are going to need, and then how can Cloudflare be contributing to those things. And they are very much not focused on shipping products, but instead helping standards develop, working with organizations and like the IETF on what the future of the internet looks like. And again, thinking about something that's almost has zero direct return on our business. I think because we have those sort of three different engineering groups that have those three different timeframes, it's allowed us to both deliver what our customers want, but then also deliver really disruptive innovation from an organization like ETI, and then also contribute back to the fundamental protocols of the internet with our technology team, who's, again, thinking on that longer time frame. And for me, that's one of the things that's the most exciting about Cloudflare, is just, I think we are one of the most innovative technology companies that's out there. And I think we built an org structure really designed around how we can continue to deliver innovation every single day that we're doing the work that we do.
We need to take a quick break. We'll be back in a minute to talk to Matthew about how he prioritizes long-term investments and, of course, how he makes decisions.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. Here's the story of innovation told in 5 words. Try. Explore. Connect. Pivot. Transform. See what happened there? As soon as Connect entered the story, innovation became achievable. That's why Deloitte works with clients and tech alliances to bring together the people, ideas, and technologies to overcome, solve, and, of course, transform. Connect to what matters for innovation. Start at Deloitte.com/US/innovate.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This week on The Pitch, would you like fries with that?
People are what make franchises run. The person who knows the business inside and out. yep. not someone who came off Wall Street because their check clears. Franchairs is the first investment marketplace where people can invest in franchises.
So you said $800 billion is what this market is a year. And hundreds of businesses are actually franchised businesses.
Thousands.
Thousands and thousands.
There are more brands franchised than there are stocks on the NASDAC.
Oh.
You're raising a $4 million price round.
And what are the terms on that?
The $19 million post-money valuation.
Oh, oh.
Yeah. And do you not think that the valuation is a little frothy?
This week, things get frothy when Kenny Rose brings a new alternative investment class to retail investors. Go right now and subscribe to The Pitch, wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're back with Cloudflare CEO Matthew Prince and the decoder questions. How does he make decisions, including some of these hard moderation calls? So you mentioned you have the three groups, and you actually just said something really interesting, which is that the longest-term group doesn't really have a measurable return. But that's like the most important group, right? The one that's working on the actual standards that make the internet go, that protect against things like, I don't know, quantum attacks on cryptography. Like, there's some really long-term things that need to be invented. How do you think about allocating the margin from like the day-to-day customers paying you to, okay, we got to invent some stuff for 5 years in the future?
You know, I think that again, we start with the mission, which is that our mission is to help build a better internet. And that means oftentimes we're doing things that don't have some direct measurable return. And maybe this sounds somewhat naive, but what we found is if we do the right thing, it pays off, but you don't always know exactly how it's going to pay off. As an example of this, you know, back in 2016, we saw, you know, a lot of foreign interference with the elections. And we thought, is there something that we can do to help with that? And so we launched something called the Athenian Project, where we provide our services at no cost to anyone originally in the US, although it's expanded now, who's helping administer an election. And there was, you know, a lot of hand-wringing from like our state, local, federal team that oh my gosh, this is going to cannibalize our business because it's something that they could sell. And now we were going to give it away for free. But at the end of the day, like if, you know, we couldn't have built the company that we did if we didn't have a sort of stable and functioning democratic government. And like, I think that we have a just duty and responsibility to, when we have the ability to, you know, protect things like how elections work, for us to not have costs be something that stands in the way of it. I'm proud of the fact that, you know, today, a majority of U.S. states, almost all of the battleground states in the U.S., the officials that administer elections there use us in various ways and have been for quite some time. There was no direct return from that. It was just, it's the right thing to do. But I think it's helped us build goodwill with governments. It's helped us build goodwill, you know, with a lot of businesses where people want to work with companies that aren't just coin operated. They want to work with companies that are principled and are trying to do the right thing. And I think that as a result of that, even though it's very hard to measure the return of these things, you know, ex ante, ex post, they have paid off in spades. And so the technology team is like that. A lot of the work that we do, you know, volunteering our services is like that. And I think our team, you know, maybe more than anything else, you know, the key to building great companies is recruiting great people. And people want to work for companies with a real mission that are doing some real good in the world. And so anytime that we do these things, whether it's, you know, help with the TLS 1.3 protocol or help protect Ukraine, you know, before the Russian invasion in 2022, that pays off, but you can't always see it where and how it's going to look in advance. So I guess the answer to your question is that we don't so much think about, you know, oh, we're going to allocate exactly this amount of margin, but we do make sure that we've got a structure in place that gives us the ability to, yes, build the things that customers want who pay us, but also build the trust, you know, in the greater market, which has turned out to be some of the best marketing and that we can do both for customers, but also for prospective new team members.
Let me push on that a little bit, but I think this is a good time to ask the decoder question. You have a lot of decisions to make. Some of them are harder than others. Some of them are more esoteric than others. How do you make decisions? What's your framework?
I keep coming back to the mission of Cloudflare. And I'll confess that, you know, I went to business school and I remember sitting in classes where people talked about the importance of mission. I'd never worked somewhere that was a really mission-driven place. I'd never been in the military. I'd never really done, you know, government service in any way. I hadn't been in a company that I would describe as extremely mission-driven. And so I kind of rolled my eyes at it. And I think that early on at Cloudflare, if you had asked, you know, what's Cloudflare's mission, I would have said, you know, our mission is to take advantage of this really unique market opportunity where the world is shifting from on-premise hardware to the cloud. And clearly the network is going to take over that. And a whole bunch of the things that were like firewalls and VPNs are going to turn into the service. And hopefully even make a little bit of money and impress our parents, which is, by the way, why most people do the things that they do.
That's a mission that inspires almost religious fervor.
Yeah. We had a chicken and egg problem where in order to, you know, make some money and impress our parents, we had to sell to really big companies that would pay us millions of dollars a year. But in order to do that, we needed to have something that was valuable to them. In order to do that, what they cared about was cybersecurity. So we needed to be able to predict who the bad guys were and stop them. In order to do that, we had to have a whole bunch of data. In order to have data, we had to have customers because the customers basically would feed the data back into the system. And so we had this problem in a simplistic way that in order to have customers, we needed to have data. In order to have data, we needed to have customers. And so being good little business students, Michelle and I said, well, what if we created, you know, a free version of our service and we'd let, you know, anyone sign up. And we expected it was going to be small businesses and individual developers that signed up. But that wasn't what happened. And the reason why is if you imagine sort of a 2x2 and the x-axis in the 2x2 is, you know, call it company size, and the y-axis is security risk. Turns out that as companies get smaller, their security risk goes way down. And there's still some momentum that keeps people from signing up for even a free service. And as companies get bigger, their security risks go up, but they're not going to trust, you know, free service. So none of those signed up. What did, though, sign up was kind of the only organizations that are in like what I would call like the Northwest quadrant of that 2x2, which are small organizations that have really big security risks. Those organizations tended to be civil society, human rights organizations. And so we woke up one day back in 2010, and it's like every human rights organization in the world had signed up for Cloudflare. There was a part of me that was like, gosh, why do we care about this? Because, you know, they're never going to pay us much. And so we're not going to make money and we're not going to impress our parents. But they keep signing up and they would write in and say, hey, it's so useful what you do. And, you know, if you're a human rights organization, you're often pissing someone off and often someone powerful. And so the powerful people would try and knock them offline. We would protect them. And I remember there was a guy who ran an organization called the Committee to Protect Journalists. And his name is Jeffrey. He wrote to me one day and he's like, hey, I've got 3 Cloudflare customers that are in town. Would you like to meet them? I rolled my eyes. Michelle was watching me. She's like, Matthew, just take the meeting. It's 15 minutes. You never know what comes out of these things. Jeffrey brought into our office, we were on 3rd Street in San Francisco, these 3 African journalists. One was from Angola, one was from Ethiopia, and the 3rd, they wouldn't tell us his name or where he was from because he was currently being hunted by death squads. It was the first meeting I'd ever been in where the term death squad had been used. We're fortunate to live in the West, but in most of the world, journalism is a very dangerous and everywhere is an incredibly noble profession. You know, in these cases, these journalists were covering largely government corruption in their home countries, and people wanted to shut them up. And so they would threaten them physically, but also do things to knock them offline. And one guy had tears in his eyes. By the end, we were all hugging. They said, you know, we couldn't do what we're doing without you. And I remember, you know, Michelle somehow at some point, you know, it was supposed to be a 15-minute meeting, and it turns into 2 hours. Michelle comes and finds me, gets dragged in the meeting. We finally walk them all out and put them in a cab in San Francisco and look at each other and like, what in the world have we gotten ourselves into? That's when the mission really crystallized. And that's when the mission became so important. I think when we started, when we said, what are we doing? We were making the internet a little bit faster and more reliable, more secure. But today, I think that as we think about things, it's much more about how do we fight to make sure the internet still exists? And as you look, you know, that, again, from the comfortable places that we sit in the West, that may not seem like a threat. But if you look at what Russia is trying to do, you look at what Iran is trying to do, Turkey, Egypt, for different reasons, India, Brazil. You can't overstate how disruptive to the traditional sources of power, be those the family, education, media, religion, government. You can't overstate how disruptive the internet was. And so, you know, the analogy that I've often used is it's sort of like episode 4 of Star Wars, you know, A New Hope, the sort of 40 years leading up to 2016. And then right around then, it flipped. And today, I don't think we can take for granted that the internet that we have known in our lives exists 40 years from now. And so I think we're very much living in a time where, you know, we have to think about how we make decisions on what's right for our business. But at the same time, we also have to think about how we make decisions to fight for the fundamental kind of existence of the internet overall. And that, for us, comes back to then, you know, what are our core values? And at Cloudflare, we are a very curious organization. We want to take on new challenges. You know, I'll never say it's not my job, you know, always going in a bunch of different directions. By the way, often to a fault. I think the biggest criticism of Cloudflare can be that we're a mile wide and an inch deep. We do a ton of different things. But again, I think that comes from curiosity. I think we're a very transparent organization. When we make mistakes, we talk about it. We do that both externally and internally. After every board meeting, we present all the slides we presented to our board, to our entire company, which people thought after we went public, there's no way we'd keep doing it, but we have. And then I think we're a very principled organization, which fundamentally means we're not going to sacrifice the short term for the long term. And so I think coming back to the mission and coming back to those core values is a lot of how we as a company and how I, as a leader of the company, make decisions.
You're talking a lot about values and mission. It's interesting to hear the CEO of what is effectively an infrastructure talk about running an infrastructure company on values and mission. Those things do come to a head, right? There's a tension there that occasionally like comes to a head. I think you can probably guess. I'm going to ask you about the Daily Stormer and 8chan and Kiwi Farms, right? These are sites that relied on Cloudflare. They were Cloudflare customers. They hosted a bunch of hate speech, a bunch of racism. They did a bunch of harassment. Basically Nazis in some cases. And you said, look, you're not going to be our customers anymore. And Cloudflare is big enough that when you say that, people do want to knock a bunch of Nazis off the internet and their sites went down because Cloudflare wasn't standing in the way. Walk me through that decision, right? Because there's a real tension between we're here to protect speech and the internet that we know. And we know that if we stop doing business with you based on our values, you will get DDoSed off the internet.
I don't want to dismiss that, you know, these are tricky issues, but they are not daily issues for us. For the most part, our business is pretty straightforward. There are things which are illegal in various parts of the world, and in those places of the world, we comply with the laws. There are then the things that are legal, but maybe, you know, gross in various ways, or someone might say, oh, I don't like that. And for those, most of the parts we say, well, you know, that's what a legislative process is for. That tends to actually work surprisingly well. You know, Cloudflare's 12 or 13 years old now, 13 years old now, I guess. We've had sort of three of these, you know, big incidents over that period of time. And so the mean time between incidents is, you know, a little over 4 years at this point. It's not like every single day we're wringing our hands and thinking about it. I think that that's different than if you're Facebook or Twitter, who really are every single day having to make these decisions. They have a much harder job because they are fundamentally the content. In our case, in order for somebody to have gotten to us, it has to be an individual makes a kind of gross decision to post something, which then doesn't get taken down by a platform, doesn't get taken down by a host, and falls kind of all the way down to the network level, which there's a lot of layers that have to kind of gone wrong there. But every once in a while, it is bound that that is going to happen. And it tends to be places that are still technically maybe legal, but are really harmful and destructive. In some cases, you know, places where we've actually worked with law enforcement and they've said, we are very worried that if this site is still online, you might see a mass shooting or you might see something else. And, you know, I think it's one of those questions where, you know, if you're living in an apartment building, generally it's not cool to like spy on what your neighbors are doing, you know, in the apartment next door. But if you see someone whose life is in danger, then yeah, you break down the door and you go help them. But that wouldn't be what you normally do. Every once in a while, we have to do that. I think the thing that is different about how we think about it than how most companies think about it. And I've had the, you know, privilege to get to sit in a lot of the public policy chats that, you know, folks like Facebook or Twitter X or AWS or Google or Apple have had. And I think that if you sat in those, you would actually feel a lot better about the companies. I think that they are almost always incredibly thoughtful people that are behind this and that have trade-offs that you might not imagine. But I think that what a lot of tech companies really believe in is they trust kind of their own internal bubble. They don't trust the rest of the world. And so they have this really almost militant secrecy about them, which I think is actually one of the real mistakes that the tech industry today is making. Whereas we really take a very transparent view of this. And so I have to confess that I didn't expect that I would spend a significant portion of the time that I talked to journalists for the rest of my career talking about neo-Nazis, because not really a topic I actually spend all that much time thinking about. But I think that the thing that we've done is that when we have come to these hard issues, we haven't just said, you know, paragraph 13G of our terms of service, beyond that, no comment. We've tried to walk through, here's why this is hard, and here's why we struggle with it. Here's the good, and here's the bad, and here's why these are tricky issues. And, you know, it just happens to be that neo-Nazis are about the grossest thing that you can imagine. And so people who are trying to be gross, you know, either are or pretend to be neo-Nazis. And so you get tough conversations around this. What's different about us than other companies is that we're willing to talk about it, whereas most other companies don't. And the reason we're willing to do that is that I think transparency is key to trust. When this first all went down with Daily Stormer, I tried to figure out how, when you get into these situations, do you show that you are being thoughtful and responsible? And I actually, you know, I went back and pulled down a bunch of, you know, philosophy textbooks, and I actually started out reading James Madison, because I thought, you know, okay, there's, in the US we have like the First Amendment. Where does that come from? And what, you know, what's behind it? Because it turns out if you go to Germany and you say, well, what about the First Amendment? Like, everyone rolls their eyes. And I think it's the wrong place to start. Where I actually think is, and again, I think the right place to start is actually around rule of law, which is actually, and Madison was really inspired by Aristotle. So I went back and read all my Aristotle textbooks. And Aristotle really believed that there were kind of three things that were inherent for a government to be trustworthy. It had to be transparent, it had to be consistent, and it had to be accountable. So you needed to know what the laws were, they needed to be consistently applied, and then the people who applied the laws had to be subject to the laws themselves. So that's basically kind of what government is. And it's really amazing. Around the world, even totalitarian governments that don't really follow the rule of law pretend to, right? They pretend to be transparent. They pretend to be
consistent. We just had elections. And, oh my God, he got voted in one more time. Yeah.
It's exactly right. And it's like, why does Russia go through the effort to do it? And it turns out that it's because that's where trust in these organizations go to. And Cloudflare is not a government, and no big tech company is. But if you think about it, on a daily basis, more people interact with Cloudflare's network than live in any country on earth. And so, while we're not a government, I think some of the principles of how large organizations build trust do apply to us. And so, again, I think we try to follow those principles of rule of law, which is transparency, consistency, and accountability. And it goes to the point of, I remember...
Wait, can I ask you about this, though?
Yeah, go ahead.
So, I believe you, and I think it is fascinating that so many tech CEOs think about the demands of running a state when they think about running their companies for their customers. And it is true. I think that's a function of scale. I just think it's fascinating that we got to Aristotle in this conversation. But when you actually went and said...
We'll do Foucault next, if you want.
Yeah, I'm ready. Nasty, Brutish, and Short, right? That's life on the internet. We'll do the whole thing. We'll go all the way back to Hobbes. But the mechanism of, I'm going to stop doing business with the Daily Stormer, famously, you're like, I woke up and decided that I was sick of it and stopped it, right? Like, mm-hmm. That's the transparency. But at the end of the day, you had the power.
Sure.
But yeah. The way that the bad thing that happened was then a bunch of people were then able to do a DDoS attack, right? Your power is sort of, in that case, contingent on knowing that there's a universe of actors who will then immediately knock the Daily Stormer off the internet. That's the relationship in your role specifically that I think is interesting, right? A hosting company has a different power, which is I'm just delete your website. An internet service provider says, we're just going to block your IP address. You're saying, I'm going to get out of the way so the mob can tear you down. And that feels like a different kind of power or a different expression of accountability. How did you think about that?
There's some truth to that, but there's also the thing about hosting providers is there's lots of them.
Yeah.
The thing about, you know, Cloudflare, and there are very few companies that can provide the services that we do. And if you piss all of us off, it's really hard to still be on the internet.
Yeah. And because there's a mob of people who will take you down.
Maybe. Right?
That's the thing. It's like, it seems like it's okay to say, I'm not going to be your security guard anymore.
Yeah, I guess. Although it turns out if you're running something even completely innocuous today,
yeah,
there's real risk that's out there. You need an immune system in order to just stay online, even if you're posting cute pictures of kittens, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's not just the neo-Nazis that get knocked offline. Everything at some point needs some level of a security guard or again, like an immune system to stay online. If you don't have that, there's just enough badness out there looking for vulnerabilities that's hard to stop. And then in addition to that, you know, just the advantages that we're able to provide in terms of performance, in terms of cost, you know, just being able to make sure your content is available everywhere in a cost-effective way. You know, if you have to exist in a world without a Cloudflare, that it's just a lot more expensive to operate. And so again, I think it comes back to that question that we ask ourselves when we were eight people above a nail salon, which is, you know, if we ran the entire internet, what would the right policy be? And again, we will never run the entire internet. Like, that's just never going to happen. But I think that that's the right mentality to think about these questions from, because I think it puts the right level of seriousness into the discussion. And then that, again, I think for our team and others, I think that's what, you know, helps us, again, really believe that none of these sites paid us anything that mattered, right? If the only thing that we were motivated by was just money, I mean, it's easy. Of course you should kick these things off. But again, I think we really do believe that we're very principled. We were very, very mission driven. And I think that's sometimes gets us into these sorts of challenges. But I'm really proud that the team that we have is thinking about them. And I hope it sets a good example for a lot of, you know, both startups and also companies that are a lot larger than we are. And it's cool that today, you know, we regularly companies that are much, much, much larger than Cloudflare that run into the same issues, you know, call us up and say, hey, we'd love your advice on this. Again, I'm proud of the fact that's a role that we're playing. And again, I think that that's an important bit in as we think about, you know, how are we going to ensure that the internet still exists? Because I don't think that's inevitable.
We need to take another quick break. We'll be right back to get into exactly why companies like Cloudflare exist and what they're actually defending us from.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brené Brown, and this is Unlocking Us. In this podcast, we'll explore ideas, stories, experiences, research, books, films, music, anything that reflects the universal experiences of being human, from the bravest moments to our most brokenhearted moments. Some episodes will be conversations with the people who are teaching me, challenging me, confusing me, maybe ticking me off a little bit. And some days I'll just talk directly to you about what I'm learning and how it's changing the way I think and feel. The first episodes are out now. We're going to do 3 or 4 part series every quarter, so about 12 to 15 episodes a year. Unlocking Us will always drop on Wednesdays. And now you can find me wherever you normally listen to your podcasts. You can get new episodes as soon as they are published by following Unlocking Us on your favorite podcast app. And as always, stay awkward, brave, and kind.
Once upon a time in America, there was no such thing as all-you-can-eat shrimp. And then the world changed.
Today, shrimp is the most popular, the most consumed seafood in America. The endless shrimp fiesta is an American institution.
But that shrimp fiesta comes at a steep price. Here at Gastropod, we found out that hidden behind the delicious shrimp on your plate is environmental disaster and modern-day slavery.
So can you have your shrimp and a clear conscience too? Actually, yes, and we've got the secret to help you unlock true, lifelong shrimp happiness. Listen to the latest episode of Gastropod wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Cloudflare CEO Matthew Prince about what modern-day cyber threats look like and why regulating companies like his is a lot trickier than it seems.
First of all, I want to point out, I think we did get to the Hobbesian state of nature on the internet, but you were saying there's enough latent badness out there that you'll just, right, true. Like red and tooth and claw will just come and kill you if you don't protect yourself or build a society. You're saying that's true. That's fascinating to me. And I think probably most listeners aren't aware of this, right? That you just put a server on the internet exposed to the wider internet, someone will come and kill you. Like that's. Yes. And explain that essential truth, because I don't think that's obvious to most people.
I mean, it has just become so efficient, if you're a bad guy, to just be able to literally scan the entire internet, to have a catalog of every vulnerability which is out there, to run through all of those. And then the value that you can derive from taking over a website, you know, publishing, you know, cute pictures about kittens, because you can create some, you know, subfolder that's child pornography, or because you can use that server to hack another server and bounce across it. I mean, it's, you know, in every bad movie featuring technology, there's a bunch of FBI agents or whatever staring at a screen saying, oh, he's bouncing the connection through 10 different satellites. So it's really hard for us to figure it out. That sort of happens. And that really is how bad guys operate online. And it is very difficult as an individual, whether that's a, you know, just someone running a kitten website, or, you know, in a small county in Georgia trying to run an election versus like the FSB, which is exactly what is going on today. And so, you know, part of what we and a handful of other companies do is make sure that you can have, again, that collective immune system that can keep you safe and can make sure that, you know, as the bad hacker comes, that you've got, you know, the forces standing up to make sure that you can stay safe no matter what.
So this makes you even more like essential infrastructure, right? You can't even do business on the internet unless Cloudflare or one of your competitors is there to protect you.
I think we have gotten to a point where it is very difficult to operate and it's what I wrote when we kicked the Daily Stormer off. There is a small group of people who make the decisions on whether or not you use these services. And the funny thing about the post that's not the actual post that we posted. That was the internal post that I wrote. It was maybe a little bit brutally honest. Mm-hmm. But the point that I was trying to make when I said, you know, I woke up in a bad mood and kicked someone off the internet was, there is some aspect to that. There is somebody that makes a decision. If I go back and I'd been fighting with my, at the time, girlfriend, now wife, over whether or not we should do this, and was always like, are even you not on my side? I think there are humans that are behind this, and you need to acknowledge that that's the case. And I think you need to set up structures.
But the trade-off here is usually as you go down the stack towards infrastructure, traditionally, we regulate those providers and say, you cannot make these decisions, mm-hmm. right? The telephone network, AT&T does not get to decide who gets to make phone calls. Everyone can just make phone calls because that's a public good. You go all the way up the stack to, I don't know, Facebook, and the First Amendment's at play. And we sort of say, you can do whatever you want all the way here, consumer facing. And if people don't like your moderation decisions, Mark Zuckerberg, theoretically, they can leave, right? The consumer market mm-hmm. is vibrant enough and transparent enough that's fine. But all the way down at the metal, right, it's we're arguing about telecom providers. We're arguing about net neutrality, right, in a way. You don't want to slow these bits down. Do you think there should be some level of regulation for a service like Cloudflare that says you can or cannot take these decisions?
I mean, there is regulation, but the tricky part is, you know, you use the example of a telecom. No,
you're reading Aristotle. Like, there's not if you're all the way back at Aristotle to come up with the first principles of decisions, there's not a rule to follow.
Sure, there is. But the tricky part is that there's a different rule to follow in almost everywhere in the world. Your frame of reference, you talk about the First Amendment, you talk about network neutrality. I mean, you're very U.S. based, like, and the U.S. I mean, none of these are all actually relatively easy issues in the U.S. because the U.S. is radically libertarian in terms of freedom of expression. I grew up in the U.S. I tend to think if you believe in innovation, if you believe in things like a free press, that does make sense. But the vast, vast, vast majority of the world doesn't believe in those things. And so there is regulation all around the world. What's different is, you know, telecoms are inherently regional businesses. Like AT&T, big deal in the U.S., but you go to England, no one's ever even heard of it. Comcast, huge deal in, you know, half the United States.
I think
States,
they've heard of the disruption of Warner Brothers at this point.
I mean, sort of, but not, but I mean, I think you'd be surprised. I mean, how many, and or Orange, like huge deal in France, right?
Yeah. Not, I'm joking, not a big deal. Yes.
We can pick whatever example you want. What has been different about the internet and the tension is that it is global from day one. You know, in Cloudflare, we launched Cloudflare, 8 people. We had customers in 10 countries the day we launched, which we were like, wow, that's amazing. By the end of the first month, we think we had customers in every country on earth. And we had 8 people. And again, that's miraculous at some level. But it's also, I think it starts to show, you know, some of the tensions that are here. And so I think the question with regulation is, whose regulation? Mm-hmm. And, you know, once upon a time, if you think about, like, think about other technologies that have come along. So think about television. So television comes out, it is this wildly successful product. In that case, it was interesting. If you think about what the risk was, and let's just focus on the U.S., there were, for reasons of physics initially, there were only 3 networks, NBC, ABC, CBS. Yeah, they competed a little bit with one another, but they effectively had an oligopoly on this new technology that existed. And so where risk would come from them was actually regulation. And so they, as an industry, got together and said, how can we fend that off in different ways? And it's led to all kinds of things. So the fact that, you know, every single, all 3 of those networks still to this day cover both political conventions, the Democrat and the Republican convention, with the same pool feed, basically, from, you know, opening speech to balloon drop at the end, that, you know, the vast majority of anchors came from like Kansas, like it way overrepresented because it was the center of the country. Equal time laws weren't proposed by the government. They were actually proposed by the networks to say, this is a way to show that we're, you know, radically neutral. That preserved the technology. In some cases, you know, there's a lot of people who say, well, you know, that was great. And I remember fondly watching Tom Brokaw or whoever, you know, growing up as a kid. But there's a lot of voices, whether they were, you know, brown voices or female voices or gay voices that just didn't appear on TV in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And so there's a trade-off that's there. And that's when the regulation is set by, you know, Lawrence, Kansas. In a global network, if we start to think about what that regulation looks like, I think that the sort of parade of horribles that we could go down is that we could actually get it set by the lowest common denominator of what every country on earth, you know, wants. And in that case, we get to sort of a Teletubbies-like internet where only the least possibly offensive thing is what can be anywhere online. And that sounds absurd. And yet, if you look at, you know, a lot of the regulation that's coming out today, I think that that's what we have to be, you know, extremely careful of. And it won't be the U.S. that sets the policy. It probably won't be Europe either. My hunch is that if that's the direction we go, that the country that ends up setting the policy is India. And that's a place where we're spending, you know, a ton of time looking at and watching. And it is very telling, the amount of investment that the major technology companies are making in that country, because they have the sort of natural gravity and they have the political will to set that policy. And I think the good news is, you know, relatively free press. The bad news is pretty scary world in terms of internet regulation, cryptography regulation. And so again, I think we've got to, is there a role for regulation? Absolutely. But you've got to think about, you know, who that is and what it looks like. And on a global network, there's a real tension that is different than you had with telecoms.
Let me make the point more regionally, right? You're saying globally, and I agree with you. I think the Modi government, yep, it's a large democracy, but the Modi government has some autocratic tendencies, especially around speech, especially around the internet. They're asserting control over it in very direct ways. The average person in Lawrence, Kansas doesn't feel that, right? They're in America. They're using American networks. And I think a more direct question is, would you be more comfortable if the United States government passed a rule that said, actually, Cloudflare can't kick people off the service? Right. And just took that decision-making authority away from you, which would preserve a more open internet, but maybe makes a different trade-off in terms of speech. Because I think the Modi government is going to tell you who you cannot do business with.
Correct.
Right. They're going to make sure that some things never arise, that some opposition parties never get access to the networks or the information ecosystem there. I'm saying here, it seems like we'd go the other way.
I don't want to speak for the Modi government or others. So,
yeah, I don't do any business in India, so I get to say whatever I want.
That's your decision.
But even here, right, you are being careful because you don't want to piss them off. And I think that's notable.
I just think that it's important to – like I don't actually know what the Modi government would do versus the opposition government in India or, you know, anywhere around the world. I know that we have to operate in lots of places around the world and we comply with the laws in all of those places. I don't know that changing the laws in the US would actually change what we have to do in other parts of the world. Or if it did, all of a sudden then we just can't be a global company. Because if you have if you set up a set of rules where you can't operate that way, then it makes sense. So we are pretty good at, again, I think following the law wherever it is. And I think clarity of law makes a ton of sense. What I'll say is I don't, again, spend a ton of time thinking about this because it's an issue that's come up three times in 13 years.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm just wondering because as your role in the ecosystem, I think is so fascinating.
I think it's worth talking about these things, even if they're not our most pressing issues, because I do think that we need to be long-term oriented as we think about this. And, you know, if the 40 years up to 2016 was a new hope, the next 40 years is the Empire Strikes Back. The AT-ATs have just landed on Hoth. And, and again, if you look at what does Russia do when they take new territory in Ukraine, one of the very first things they do is they find the sort of the ISP and telecom headquarters, and they reprogram the routers to route the traffic back through Russia. Why do they do that? Because controlling communications is so critically important. That's the other side of this. And it is not inevitable that the internet exists the way it does 40 years from now. And I'm proud of the role that Cloudflare is playing in helping defend what, again, I think is one of the great inventions of human history and one that's worth fighting for.
You've mentioned Russia and Ukraine several times now. You're obviously supporting a bunch of customers in Ukraine. You have also said that just disconnecting Russia from the global internet would be a mistake. And the quote here is, the consequences of such a shutdown would be profound, and that Russia needs more internet access, not less.
Yep.
This concept is broadly called the splinternet, right? The idea that every country is going to sort of invent its own internet. We can see it here in this country, right? There's different state laws now that sort of determine what services are available depending on age or pornography or what people think about protecting children. Do you see that coming here? Do you see the splinternet taking root here? Kicking TikTok off our internet in some way appears to be in vogue. Do you see that coming here?
You can't overstate how disruptive the internet was to what are the five traditional sources of power in society that have been the case since, you know, we climbed out of whatever swamp we climbed out of, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago. Family, religion, government, media, education are where power traditionally has come from. And the internet disrupted them all in various forms. And they are trying to push back. It's not that the internet isn't without faults. And we should be honest about those and talk about those faults. But we should also be very careful not to, you know, give up on what is there. And so as I look at it, you know, the leaders in trying to, China is really interesting and really smart in that they never really let the internet in. They and North Korea are basically the only countries on earth that never let the internet in. A lot of other countries today are looking at what China has and says, you know, that doesn't seem so bad. Maybe we can recreate that. And so I think the question is, can other countries get the horse back in the barn? We're trying very hard to make that difficult for, you know, the Russias and Irans of the world, to make it so that, you know, if they want to have access to the APIs that drive, you know, oil trading markets, that they also have to, you know, let the Navalny Foundation or Bellingcat be able to broadcast, you know, information about the corruption of the Putin regime. And we're really good at making that a very difficult thing for them to block. That's earned us, you know, some challenges. I'm personally sanctioned by the Russian government, which was a sort of surreal thing to have happen. But again, I sort of wear that as a badge of honor and think that that's us doing the right thing, fighting for the internet overall. And so I think that we should worry about the sort of TikToks, like bans and porn filters and things. But I think that those are, you know, the sort of small stakes compared with, you know, what are some of the really, really big stakes efforts where, you know, Russia and Iran are basically saying, can we recreate the same filtering engines that someone like China has? And if they do, you know, it won't stop there. It'll happen then next in Turkey. It'll happen next in Egypt. And it won't stop there either. You know, India, Brazil,
yep,
Canada. And eventually, you know, governments want to be able to control how information is disseminated.
You mentioned a technical capability there that feels like a policy, right? If you want access to these oil trading APIs, you need to make sure Bellingcat is available. That's just a policy you're enforcing. Do you see other technical evidence of this inside the Cloudflare network that gives you pause?
I think we've made it very difficult to block any one site on Cloudflare inside Russia without blocking all of Cloudflare. Mm-hmm. We're at a scale where blocking all of Cloudflare is tough. And it's interesting to look at what Russia hasn't been able to block. So the fact that YouTube is still available, I think is actually really interesting point. And I think, you know, I've spent actually quite a bit of time talking to policymakers and people who are much deeper experts about this. And, you know, they've said that at the end of the day, a Russian family still relies on something like YouTube to entertain kids. And if Putin shuts that down, that he has a problem, you know, with the average Russian family. In our case, there's just enough things that the Russian economy depends on that run on Cloudflare that you can also have, you know, folks like Bellingcat. It's very difficult to block one without blocking the other. These are the sorts of things that we don't make any money off of, but we think are important policy decisions to be thinking about as a fundamental internet, you know, infrastructure provider.
You mentioned Bellingcat, all these sites. You're basically mentioning websites, right? Or like servers on the internet in some way. I look at the web and I see this like slow deterioration of web content because of AI, right? Like all the web is being flooded with like C+ AI generated content and all the action is sort of on platforms. And so it's actually interesting to say they can't block YouTube because they can't go into YouTube and filter YouTube directly. Like Google just runs that as a service. China might be able to filter the web more directly and block some sites versus others. How do you feel about the state of the web today? I've been asking a lot of CEOs that because all of us, built companies because of the richness of the web and our ability to meet customers right away because of the web. And as things head towards platforms and the web gets overrun with AI, that might be changing in a huge way.
For us, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter how you're consuming the content, whether or not like that's on your, you know, desktop or a mobile device, whether that's through a browser or an app. You know, I think behind the scenes, you know, a huge amount of what we see is processed through APIs. So APIs make up, you know, 57% of the traffic that we processed last year. And so that's maybe not a traditional website. I think the web is probably the easiest thing for most people to relate to. But at the end of the day, it's just anytime you're accessing content online, if there's a network, you know, involved, then I think that we play, you know, some role in that. I think these things evolve and change over time. The death of the web has been predicted many, many, many times. And again, it still keeps emerging. There was a, you know, period of time in the early web history where, you know, the search technology that we had wasn't good enough. That's where Google came from, was, you know, building something that was just a better way to filter through all of the garbage that was out there. So I guess I'm a little bit more optimistic that fundamentally people are trying to figure out how to communicate. People are trying to figure out, you know, how to find the answer to the problems that they have and find, you know, innovative new solutions. And yeah, there will be, you know, things that make that harder and there will be then things that make that easier. But over time, if you look at it, like the growth in overall internet traffic spiked enormously during COVID, and then that is slowed down. But last 2 years, it's still grown almost 25% year over year, which is an extraordinary growth rate this far into the internet. I think that if you started to see the utility of the internet slowing down, you would see the usage slowing down. And that's that's not just because we're bringing, I mean, it's amazing we've brought 4 billion people online. It's disgraceful that there are 4 billion people who are not online. But it's not just that. Even if you look at developed markets, you're still seeing double-digit, you know, growth rates in internet usage. And I think that's the best predictor of, is there still real value, which is coming from it. And so, you know, I think we can wring our hands about, is AI going to destroy the web or not? I'm still optimistic that having networks that connect people together, people are going to use that to communicate and find answers to questions. And if the current tools that we have, you know, if Google isn't sufficient to sort the wheat from the chaff, then there will be a new Google.
I think Google hopes there's not a new Google, but we'll see how that goes.
I would guess that whoever that new Google is will use Cloudflare. So
there you go. See, it's all just customers for you. Let me bring this all the way back around. We've had what I would call a very idealistic conversation, and maybe we should get to John Rawls now, although we have not done Locke, and I feel like you have to do Locke.
You
have to put Rawls in opposition to Locke. But we had a very idealistic conversation. I would cynically say an idealism for a company like Cloudflare is a function of margin, right? You are able to invest in long-term internet thinking. You are able to sit around thinking about these really hard decisions and supporting customers that you think are morally correct to support, even though they don't pay you a lot of money. You've had to preserve those margins recently, right? You did layoffs. There was a very famous video of a person being
laid off. We've never done a layoff.
Well, there's that video.
We fire people.
You fire people. So you don't think of those as layoffs?
No, because I mean, if somebody doesn't do their job well, then we'll fire a person. But a layoff is a very specific thing where you're saying we need to, you know, increase our margin. We've never made a determination on letting go an employee for a margin reason. I think that
because a lot of tech companies have been doing this, right? They say we overinvested, we're getting smaller. I guess you fired a bunch of people recently because you thought you were too big.
And again, I don't think we even fired a bunch of people. We fired about the same number of people that we normally fired. COVID had some really interesting effects. I think one is that, you know, in 2020 we really stopped firing people, because we're human. Right? People were suffering. We wanted to take care of them. Some people just expected that would be the state of how things went on forever, that you could join a company. Not literally, we had people who, you know, for 6 months didn't do a single thing as far as we could tell. And yeah, that at some point you got to get back to actually doing work. And so, you know, if you don't do work, then we're going to let you go. But again, that's not because we were too big. That's just because you need to have people who are actually doing their jobs. And so I think we should focus on that. I think we've actually been unbelievably disciplined in the rate at which we've hired, and our margins have stayed kind of exactly the same for quite some time as a result of that. You know, when you hire someone, it's a big deal. It's a responsibility that you have. I'm incredibly proud that, like, last year we had 1.2 million people apply to work at Cloudflare, which is just extraordinary. You know, we hired about 1,000, a little over 1,000 of those, and we do a pretty good job of that. But every once in a while, we make decisions, or someone just isn't the right fit, or, you know, some people just, sometimes the job grows more than they do, and it's not the right thing. And when we do that, we, I think, in a as responsible way as possible, we try to, you know, let people go. But it's a relatively small part of the team, and I think we do a good job of it.
So I'm asking specifically about this video that you said was painful to watch for the person being fired. Yep. You're actually hitting on something that I was going to ask you about as well, which is last year you fired about 100 people and you said they weren't doing very well. And you're saying that again here. You were criticized for that, right? You're saying you shouldn't – people basically said you shouldn't disparage people even though you're firing them for underperforming. You should just let them go live their lives. You seem to have a different approach, right? A different thought about being – in the culture of the company is radical transparency. It seems like you're carrying that through even to this moment at the end.
I want to be very careful. It would be incredibly unfair for me to talk about the woman who posted the video. I mean, we have a much bigger megaphone and we could walk through all the reasons for her being let go. That would be totally, totally, totally irresponsible. What I will say is that it's incredibly costly to hire someone and then have them not work out. So it's in our interest for everyone to work out. Not everyone does. And when they don't, that doesn't mean they're a bad person. It doesn't mean they won't be an incredible employee somewhere else. They just weren't the right person for us. And sometimes that's their fault. Sometimes it's our fault. You know, it can be a number of different things. I think I remember I was at a job and I got fired because I wasn't very good at the job. I still remember it and it was super painful, but I learned from it. And with, gosh, at this point, almost 30 years of hindsight, they were right to fire me. I was kind of but I'm a better employee today because of that. So we can't get to a point where we just say, everyone is great and everyone gets a medal and everyone gets a trophy. There are people who perform better than others, and we have a certain amount of work to get done. The worst thing that you can do as an organization is hold on to your low performers, because that not only is wasteful, but it actually is incredibly discouraging to your high performers. That doesn't mean that again, anyone who we've let go won't be a great person somewhere else. Or even if we'd done if we'd trained them in a different way, maybe they would have been, you know, they would have been better. But for us at that moment in time, they weren't the right person. And I think that as you hire people, no matter what, you've got to be really, really thoughtful around this. And it was, you know, I remember in early 2022, like every story was about how it was going to be the great resignation. Every employee was going to quit. Meanwhile, we're looking at the data and we're like, seems like the economy is going to slow down. So all my peers are like, we're hiring as fast as we can and blah, 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 blah. And then it turned out no one quit. Like the great resignation never showed up. And I remember thinking, gosh, maybe we're doing this wrong. Because, you know, companies I really respect, I would talk to their CEOs and they would say, yeah, we're hiring as quickly as we can. We're like, gosh, all the data sort of suggests that we're about to slow down. And so we're actually kind of pulling back on hiring right now. And that was a very scary and risky decision. But I think it's part of what then has allowed us to not have to do layoffs and to be able to, you know, be someone who's been able to continue to invest. Because it's always incredibly costly and just disruptive and demoralizing if you have to do this. On the other hand, if you don't let go of low performers, that's also incredibly disruptive and demoralizing. And so I think we have to be very clear. It is irresponsible as a company to overhire and then have to lay a bunch of people off, even if they're performing well. But it's also irresponsible as a company to have low performers who you don't lay off as individuals, because again, that's bad for the company and it's bad for the high performers that are there.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. My question is a little bigger and I want to end up here. It's about having the space to have your values, right? And a lot of the other big companies in tech preached their values for a decade or more, right? We're connecting the world. We're going to make the world a better place, famously. And then the margin pressure did come and they did overhire and that they made layoffs. And now they're kind of more ruthlessly focused on profitability. And the values seem to have gone away. Is that something you're worried about? Because so much of this conversation has stood out to me because of how often you come back to the values and the mission of the company. And that I'm watching other big companies sort of immediately make that trade-off. And I'm just wondering if you ever feel that pressure or how you think about it. Because it feels like that will determine the future of Cloudflare as much as anything else.
Michelle and I are fundamentally focused on being just incredibly efficient, you know, business leaders. We often joke that we're, you know, scared squirrels at the end of the day, where I think that we believe that, you know, every dollar of investor capital that we're trusted with, every dollar that a consumer pays us, that we have to deliver a really substantial return for that. And I'm super proud of the fact that we did that for all of our investors before we went public, and we're way up from our IPO price, and we, you know, continue to be able to deliver, you know, very consistent and long-term results. And we have always focused on efficiency. We've never been the place that wastes money on fancy cafeterias or conference tables. We have very functional, basic, you know, offices, and I don't live a particularly fancy life, and neither does Michelle. Because again, what we're focused on is building what is a really great business. We've done that for a long time now. We've done that for 13, 14 years. And over that time, I think we've built a lot of trust with the investing community. And if you look at, even as a public company, who are our top 10 shareholders, you know, it's been remarkably stable over that period of time. And you look at, you know, firms like Baillie Gifford that are a big, you know, investor in Cloudflare, their average holding period is 16 years. And so they really are focused on the long term. I think if you chase short-termism, if you look for that and you run your business that way, then you will get investors that behave that way. But if you really do think about the long-term, if you are really mission-driven, then you'll also get investors and customers that are focused on the long-term and will let you do that as well. And so I'm not saying it won't come at some point, but I think both a combination of doing what we say and saying what we do, being incredibly consistent, really focusing on long-term value creation for every one of the stakeholders that we serve, including, you know, the general public, that has given us that freedom to be able to continue to innovate. And I think that it's also one of the real powers of being a founder-led company. The fact that Michelle and I are still showing up every day to work, that lets us do that. Because again, it's a level of consistency. And I can't imagine anything that I could do that would be more meaningful or more impactful. I think as long as we do what we say we do, hopefully we'll always have the ability to build a great business, but also do those things which are living up to our mission, which is again, to help build a better internet.
Yeah. Well, I can't think of a better place to end it. Matthew, thank you so much for being on Decoder.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to thank Matthew Prince for taking the time to join Decoder and get deep into the weeds of political philosophy. I'd also like to thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. If you have thoughts about this or any other Decoder episode, you can email us at decoder@theverge.com. We really do read all the emails. You can also hit me up on Threads. I'm at Reckless1280. And we have a TikTok. It's at DecoderPod, and it's a lot of fun. If you like Decoder, please share it with your friends. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Decoder is a production of The Verge, part of the Vox Media Podcast Network. Today's episode was produced by Kate Cox and Nick Statt. It was edited by Callie Wright. Our supervising producer is Liam James. The Decoder music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. We'll see you next time.